to order, and we apologize for being about an hour late. Too much is going on in a very short time. The first one we want to bring up, back up, is House Bill 61, and we had a discussion yesterday, and I got my questions answered. And does anyone else have any questions they want to offer, or any concerns, or Senator Dyson?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I've learned a couple of things that are of some value. When I asked yesterday if people would make a business out of going around finding charities to help, the answer was no. And I found it since, and I should have known it, but the term operators and is a term of art in our law, and it means somebody that's licensed and bonded. But there's nothing that will keep enterprising individuals from going to someone who's doing a sporting event and making a deal to do a Calcutta pool and go and finding some charity that will lend their name to it, you know, and they will create business and do some good for the charity. But I think there'll be some folks who will see this as an opportunity to make it happen. And I found out that in other states there have been some fixes, particularly when, or situations like when there's a Calcutta pool going on, playing pool, and there have been cases, I understand, where they have bid the pool really up, and then the players make a deal between them so that their guy wins, and they sandbag the thing and make it happen so that they end up fixing the game, and that we may see some of these evolve around some of the major sporting events, like say some of the major hockey games or so on in town, that I think we will see some unfortunate things come out of it. So I have the advantage and disadvantage in knowing a lot of scoundrels who can find a way to make money out of almost anything, and it'll be interesting to watch over the years and see if that happens with this. I hope not. And that's all I have.
Jalon, did you have anything to respond? Okay, thank you. Okay.
Madam Chair?
Senator Stedman?
Is the intent here to move this, or
yes. Did you have some concerns, or did you have a question?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not real comfortable with enlarging the gambling opportunities in the state in general. And if that is the decision of the chair, that's fine. We can move this forward. But in the end, I don't think I'm going to be supportive of this particular measure.
Okay. Thank you. I know in the conversation I had yesterday, and I think the reality is this is already taking place in our state, and not that that makes it okay, but this does give, I know like the folks who called yesterday from the Palmer Golf Course, gives them the ability to be the host at events where a reasonable fundraising can take place, as well as have someone as a winner. So I do have one question. Could you come up and let's see, maybe we can. Is there a mechanism when you conduct the event the night before the event that accounts for every dollar that comes in, so that you have, I guess, what is it, a 50-50 share?
Yes, Madam Chair.
It is. Go ahead and give your name, please.
For the record, my name is Shalon Szymanski, and I'm staff to Representative McGuire.
Okay. Explain that again.
There is actually, Madam Chair, do you mean keeping track of the money raised? There is a section in the bill. Let me pull it up here. A report actually has to be filed with the department after a Calcutta pool is held. And that's a form that the department, I don't believe they've created the form yet, but it would, I assume, include keeping track of the money raised and the money going to the charity. Let's see here. And that is section two of the bill.
Shall file a report for each pool conducted. Is that before or after?
That would be after.
That's the after, Madam Chair. Okay. The amount, if you could go to line 8 on page 2, the amount and nature of each expense, and what would that include?
Madam Chair, I would believe that that would be anything from if when you're having an auction, to whether it be banners for advertising in the building saying this is the event that we're holding. I'm not, unfortunately, I haven't been to one of these events myself.
Okay, because I'm trying to find out. Explain to me again how the event the evening before takes place and what the expense for the operator or the host of the event would be that are allowable under this.
Madam Chair, it would be the way the event is ran is at, it's usually in a banquet the night before. They'll hold an auction. At the auction, they would auction off the different teams that will be participating in the tournament the following day. People will then place wager, or they'll bid on the team that they believe will win that tournament. Then the following day, after the tournament is done, the high bidder on the winning team would then get 50% of the money raised. Or it, actually, it could be, it's up to the person holding the event, whether they want to give more to the charity or not, but no less.
At a minimum of 50%?
I'm sorry, I actually misspoke. It would be, the bill reads that no less than 50% goes to the charity. So it would be up to the organization holding the event as to whether they could give 100% to the charity if they wanted. It just, it depends on the organization holding the event. And they would obviously specify that prior to the auction.
Okay, is it 50% of the money taken in, or is it 50% of the money after these things are deducted?
The way I've understood it, it would be 50% of the money raised in the pot.
Thank you.
Yes.
Are there any other questions for Sean? Cindy Wilkin.
Madam Chair, move to report House Bill 61 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Is there objection? There being no objection, House Bill 61 moves from committee with individual recommendation and attached fiscal notes. House Bill 149. I know we have some people here who wish to testify. Is there anything you need to, any information you need to bring us forward with from yesterday's meeting? Go ahead.
Oh, I just was saying hello, Madam Chair.
Hello. Are there any further statements from you or your staff from yesterday's meeting, or did you have any questions asked of you that you want to answer? Because I'm sorry, I did not get to attend that meeting. Did you have anything
Madam
to follow
Chair,
up on?
Maybe if I could, when you had to leave yesterday, we had a nice discussion for about a half hour about the bill itself, and it's centered around the logbook issue. So some folks have come in and visited with, I hope with Representative Ramirez, although I know you've been busy, but have visited with a number of us, and they're here today to provide from the retailer's standpoint what the logbook does. I think that would help us, because we had yesterday there were some blanks that we couldn't fill in. So I think that's where we are in your absence.
Okay, thank you. We'll have Glenn Peterson and Jason Moulton come forward, please. And is there, do we have a sign-up sheet over there? Okay. Welcome. If you could give your name and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Glenn Peterson. I'm from Car Safeway in Anchorage, District Manager.
My name is Jason Moulton. I'm the Loss Prevention Director for Safeway Seattle Division. I'm based in Bellevue, Washington.
Thank you. Would you like to give us the information you flew in to share with us?
Yes. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. The first thing that we'd like to do from Safeway's standpoint is we'd certainly like to applaud the efforts of the state of Alaska to address a very difficult problem that is methamphetamine addiction within your state. By way of background, I spent the past 30 years up until the year 2000 as a special agent of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and I retired from that position as an assistant special agent in charge of the Seattle office. I then became the Loss Prevention Director for Safeway Incorporated in Seattle, and have worked in that position up to the present time. As soon as I took over this position, I became acutely aware of the problems that the retailers are facing as a result of the methamphetamine addiction issue in the state of Washington and in the states where we operate. The Seattle Division, as you may be aware, operates in the four-state area of Washington, Alaska, Montana, Idaho. And this problem has become even more acute over the past several years. In 2003, I was selected, nominated, and appointed to the Governor Locke's Governor's Council on Substance Abuse. And in that capacity, I've worked closely with those people who deal with methamphetamine abuse on a daily basis. I'm currently a member of methamphetamine task forces in the counties of King, Snohomish, Thurston, Pierce, and Spokane. And so I'm very attuned to the issues that your state is beginning to deal with today, and we applaud you for the things that you're doing, and specifically applaud you for strengthening the penalties associated with methamphetamine abuse, and particularly the reckless disregard for those young children who are involved in, or their parents or other ones are involved in methamphetamine use in their homes or residences. And approximately 2 years ago, Safeway decided to be a good corporate citizen and to continue to take appropriate action without mandate by regulatory authorities. And what we did at that time was we pulled what we regard as the high theft pseudoephedrine products from our stores, and we replaced them instead with pieces of plastic. And so when you go to our stores, you cannot acquire the product in open shelving. We did this in self-defense. Essentially, many of the products were being shoplifted, and we were receiving no money of value for them. And so as a result of this, we placed those products behind the customer service counter, and we sell them in exchange for these small pieces of plastic, which are scanned, paid for, and then the product is given to the individual. We limited the products to 3 per transaction, and that has been very effective in helping us to curb our losses, and also, we believe, to curb the methamphetamine precursor problem within the state of Washington particularly. And I'll comment for just a moment a couple of other things that we have done. One of the things that we have done is we have become the largest corporate sponsor of Meth Watch. We sponsor Meth Watch in the state of Washington and the state of Montana. And in every one of our stores, including in this state, we have the Meth Watch posters up so that our associates, our employees, become aware of the dangers of methamphetamine and the different precursors that are associated with that. We believe that the participation in Meth Watch, the polling of the product, the using the employment of scan and serve techniques and our corporate emphasis on this problem have helped to reduce the methamphetamine problem in the state of Washington. In fact, if you look at our statistics, in 2001, we had the dubious distinction of being the second largest state in terms of meth labs in the country, with 1,886 meth labs reported to the Department of Ecology. In 2004, that number has dropped to 1,339, and at presently in 2005 year-to-date, we have 261 meth labs that have been reported through the end of March of 2005. So we believe that the effect of the voluntary pulling of the product and the retailers, and most of them have complied with that, is having the desired effect to reduce the availability of the precursors for methamphetamine. Unfortunately, that's not the end of the story. The best information that we have after all the things that we have done within the state of Washington is that the cost of methamphetamine today is at either the same price or perhaps lower than it was several years ago. And based upon supply and demand theory of economics, that would tell us that we're probably not doing much to change the situation. The other thing that we have found, and this is available on a website, questdiagnostic.com, if you look up that website, what you'll find is that they're seeing extreme increases in the number of methamphetamine individuals who are being tested in the workplace. And this number is going up dramatically each year. And so the problem continues unabated. Another indicator of the extent of the problem in the state of Washington, and perhaps in your state if you check these figures, would be the number of people who are receiving treatment from government facilities. These would be the people who receive Medicaid treatment, the government, either the federal government or the state government, paying for it. We're seeing a tendency that the people that are being treated are much younger, now 14 years of age, and that the numbers, the gross numbers, are increasing. In 2003, which are the latest statistics that I have, we treated over 12,000 individuals in the state of Washington for methamphetamine addiction in that state alone. Unfortunately, the problem with that particular addiction is that this is not a situation like cocaine and sometimes like heroin, where we can send them away for 30 days, they can get the cure and it's solved. 30 days is merely a deposit or a down payment on helping to solve the problem. And frequently, after they've gone to the treatment, you're still having to deal with them a year later, because methamphetamine, unfortunately, is like having a very highly barbed hooked into the mouth of the person, and they simply can't get over it. They can't get it out of their mouth. They can't get past that point. And the last statistic I'll give you is drug submissions. In the state of Washington, we've been watching the drug submissions submitted by law enforcement to our drug laboratories, and what we're finding is that our drug submission to the laboratories now are represented by 46% are methamphetamine. The nearest, the closest other drug to it is cocaine at 26%, and all the other drugs are in single digits. And so clearly, methamphetamine is the drug of choice. It's the drug that was most frequently encountered by law enforcement within our state. And I would dare say that these statistics applied to your state would be equally as valid. We've been asked to comment specifically on the bill, Bill 149. And we have some suggestions, some concerns, and some suggestions. The Governor's Council in the state of Washington made three suggestions, and they said that essentially you need to do three things. You need to work on prevention, you need to work on treatment, and you need to focus on law enforcement and justice. Bill 149 is clearly an excellent bill dealing with law enforcement and justice, but I caution that without the other two legs, so that's three-legged stool, you're going to find yourself in very quick difficulties, where you're going to have a lot of people incarcerated with no ability to fund treatment and no ability to preclude them from getting into the problem because of not funding the prevention. So just remind you about the three-legged stool. We provided to Senator Wilkin today a report, which is the governor's report or the recommendations of the governor's council in the state of Washington from 2000. Particular topic. I think it's wisdom, and I think there's excellent information that might guide the state of Alaska as they looked at that report. The a couple of specific things that we would like to recommend with regards to Bill 149. One of the issues that we found on page 4, line 9, has to do with some exceptions to organizations that would be allowed to have more than 24 grams of pseudoephedrine. We would ask that that would also be amended to include bulk orders. In many of our stores, we prepare what we refer to as bulk orders. These are bulk orders placed by boats, which are sent out from the fishing fleet. And oftentimes, the quantity of pseudoephedrine that is sent out with them exceeds the 24-gram limit.
Mr. Bolton, are you referring to page 4, line 9?
Page 4, line 9, I believe, in my document.
And what are you saying?
On page 4, line 9, it says less than 24 grams of ephedrine, pseudoephedrine. It's how it starts out, and it gives an exemption to camps, lodges, schools, daycares, treatment centers, and so forth. The exception that would be helpful to the retailers up here, and I don't know how many other retailers are affected by this, but we regularly prepare what we refer to as boat orders. Boats come in, they pick up items from us, and they frequently, in those orders, they request more than 24 grams of pseudoephedrine product.
Okay. Do you do rural?
I'm sorry?
I was asking Mr. Peterson, do you do rural?
Yes.
Would that be the case for
in many
shipping
cases.
To some?
Because yes,
I know we have a lot of people who call in and have their products flown out to where they live. And
in some of our remote locations, like in Nome, yes, many of the villages outside will call in with orders.
Okay.
As well.
So that could be the equivalent to the boat order he's talking about.
Possibly. And we also, in Dutch Harbor, for instance, they will come in and a fishing boat going out for
sure.
3 months
okay.
or a month at a time.
Okay. Thank you.
The next point we'd like to make, and I did have an opportunity this morning to listen to the hearing from yesterday evening, and one of the things that I did not hear, and I wanted to make that point, and I'm sure that everyone's aware of it, and perhaps it's just not been voiced, but there are three crimes that are inseparably connected, or at least in my experience and based upon the information I currently have available. Those three crimes are methamphetamine, both the production and the use of methamphetamine, identity fraud or identity theft, and mail theft. Those three crimes are inseparably connected. And every time, or most every time, a search warrant is executed at a meth house, meth production facility, you're going to find false ID, you're going to find counterfeit checks, wash checks, or information that allows you to do those other crimes. With that being said, may I first of all explain the current record-keeping system that most major retailers use. The current record-keeping system, when you come into Safeway, to Fred Meyer, or other similar retailers, we use what we call point of sale, and we have a scanner. When you scan the item, it keeps a record of the items that are in that specific order. At the end of the order, we are going to tender some type of money, a credit card, a debit card, a gift card, an EBT card, or a check to pay for the order. All of that material is instantaneously copied, essentially by computer, and is available in some database that exists, and our database exists down in both in Salt Lake City, Utah, and in Phoenix, Arizona. And so it's retrievable. It's immediately retrievable for a window of 90 days. Going back beyond that, it sometimes will take me a day to get that information, and going back up to 5 years, it can take me a couple of days to get the information, but the information is highly retrievable. We also keep records in most of our stores where we employ a digital closed-circuit television. We keep records of people entering the store, exiting the store, purchasing items at the cash registers, at our customer service counter, and in some areas where we have high theft, we actually photograph on the aisle where the pseudoephedrine used to be displayed. And so it's possible that we would have a record of the person actually selecting the item, paying for the item, and exiting the store with the item. That is a record-keeping system we have in place today. It is our belief that the log that has been proposed by this legislation is not necessary. It is redundant. that is expensive for us to put into effect, and it serves no useful purpose beyond the logs which we already maintain in the normal course of business. We comply with subpoenas on a regular basis, we comply with search warrants on a regular basis, and we voluntarily provide closed-circuit TV evidence routinely to law enforcement upon request. And we will continue to do that. In the Meth Watch program, we voluntarily provide information to local law enforcement, including license plates of people who we believe are buying precursors for the use of methamphetamine, and we would continue to do that under that program. The other objection we have to the log is what would be required in the log. We would anticipate that a log, to be of any use to law enforcement, would need to be sortable in some fashion. And in my days in the FBI, that meant that we have a last name in one field, a first name, a middle initial, that we would have a date of the transaction, the type of transaction, where was it they were purchasing, the quantity of the transaction, and the person who did the transaction with the buyer. I think that any log that could be anticipated would include at least those items. Can you imagine how long that would take if we were to do that manually? Our normal transaction to sell an item of pseudoephedrine probably would take less than 30 seconds. By the time we completed that log, it would extend that period of transaction to a much larger time length. And if the item were to, if we were required eventually, and I know it's not anticipated in this law, but in Oklahoma, what is anticipated now is the electronic submission of the logs. That may require also the additional purchase for retail establishments of some type of a rational database, an Excel database or something, and some hardware in order to accommodate that. The other problem that we see with the log requirement is that there appears to be a statement in which it appears that city by city in the state of Alaska, they may change the rules on how often we have to report, what should be reported, and the format that the report should come in. That's very difficult for us to administer in a situation where we're a multiple state corporation. At the current time, I'm administering different programs in the state of Montana, a different program for one store, which I have in Oregon, a different program for all the stores that I have in Washington, and now yet another program that could be different city by city in the state of Alaska. And that's very difficult for us to do to ensure compliance. The last issue is the compliance issue. We would anticipate, oftentimes as government has a tendency to do, and rules are enacted, and then eventually someone needs to ensure that we, the retailers, are following through. The difficulty with that is that someone would have to come and check, is Safeway keeping the logs, or is Safeway making sure that the logs are being kept private, is Safeway selling more than the quantities that are required, and then would there be is it anticipated that there would be a citation or some type of penalty associated with that? These are certainly things that we would hope would not happen, but we certainly have no guarantee that that would not happen. We have conservatively estimated the cost to put the logging system in place in our 25 stores. Certainly we're a very large Fortune 500 company. We can absorb the cost, but the cost would estimate to be approximately $250,000 in labor costs alone. There would also be the additional cost associated with training, the hours for the training of our personnel, and then retraining because of the number of changes in personnel we have. And then in the event that we're required to submit information electronically, that would require the additional cost of software and hardware associated with this law. We certainly applaud everything that has been recommended in terms of stiffening the sentences. However, we would certainly like to work closely with the representative Ramros and Senator Guest with regard to the logging requirement and have some input on that and possibly if we can to avoid having to deal with the log in our stores. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much for coming. Your information is really very enlightening and kind of scary to know that they really do know all this terrible things in the junk we're buying when we go grocery shopping. We just thought you were going to sneak it out. In the in a sort of particularly in a state like Alaska, what percentage of the population do you think is served by a Cars, a Safeway, a Fred Meyer, a Walmart that would have a similar scanning system to yours?
All of our metropolitan areas. Then in Nome, for instance, we have a store there.
And you have a similar system in place as
absolutely,
well?
Absolutely, same thing. Yes. Dutch Harbor. We're throughout the state. However, there are, as we all know, there's a lot of smaller towns and villages that I'm not sure. I think AC would probably be a good, Alaska Commercial might be a good one to talk to in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure exactly what their POS system is. However, it would probably be something comparable.
Yeah, cause my point was, you know, if you're saying that this part is redundant, how much of the state is already being served in some way or another where that information is very readily retrievable. And because I know some of the members have concern about the log session, SOC section, and want to be sure we get this on its way, but have it in a condition that it's acceptable for all of us, and we certainly want to work with the sponsor as well. Are there other questions?
Actually, I do have.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. What alternative do you have or have you thought about for the logs that would allow some type of tracking of the product, especially if exorbitant amounts are being purchased?
Well, the first thing in what we've done in the state of Washington has been the use of the Meth Watch program. And basically what that is when we see an individual who comes in, and we see them coming in day after day, the same people, or we see people that we refer to as tweakers coming in, and we observe that, and we see them buying pseudoephedrine, and we see them buying batteries, and we see them buying acetone and coffee filters. That tells us we've got a meth lab or a meth lab wannabe, and that's when we hopefully will pick up the phone, call local law enforcement and say, hey, here's the license plate, we got the pictures, and this is the person. And if you'll give us a subpoena or a search warrant, we'll provide you the information that we have in our files relating to that transaction. And so that, I think, is a very viable alternative to the log.
Anyone else? Senator Herbert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, sir, for being here this afternoon. Other than the boat orders and the issue of the logs, is the rest of the legislation acceptable?
I believe so. I certainly the enhancements of the criminal penalties, I think, are wonderful, and specifically the enhancement that you've recognized, the reckless disregard of those under the 18, I think is commendable. That certainly is something that needs to be done. So I do not have an issue with any of the rest of the legislation.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Oh, Senator Stedman.
I've had some concerns from some of the pharmacies in my district over the issue of the log and how it's going to be maintained and the time it's going to be, time's going to be spent and the potential burdensome issues. The pharmacists I've spoken to are supportive of the direction of what this legislation is heading. There's just some concerns about on a much smaller scale than the testimony today, that, you know, the mom and pop, a lot of them have, do not have point of sale.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes it a little bit more awkward.
Anything else, gentlemen? Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate your insight.
Thank you.
Yeah, it sounds like you've been through this before. Dean, do you and the sponsor's staff want to come to the table and let's kind of talk about this and see if we could figure out something in between A and B? Yeah. I know several of the members have mentioned their concern with that section. And have you had other discussions about that? And how have you addressed the concern? And is there a fallback position? Is there a... Because I understand what's the attempt is, but is there earlier in the section, like the gentleman from Safeway were talking about, the person that's observed in the store and the one buying, you know, X number of Sudafedrin each day and the coffee filters and all the requisite products, is there anything in here that requires any kind of, if someone suspects because of the variety of products they see them buying every day, they would report it? Or,
Madam Chair, there's nothing in here that requires reporting of the other products. I do note that there are, I think, statutes from other states that do require reporting of what they term suspicious transactions and things of that sort, but this bill does not go that far, does not impose those kind of burdens on retailers.
Okay.
And I think even the state of Washington has statutes about required reporting of suspicious transactions as well. In fact, at least Representative Ramos's office gave me what appears to be a copy of the Washington statute, which requires, if not a logbook, then certainly taking down of a large amount of information about the purchasers of pseudoephedrine products, including driver's license, vehicle license, how the product is going to be used, the signature of the purchaser, and it appears to require that the seller actually countersign that as a witness. So I think that there are some states that go further than we propose to go in this bill, and mm-hmm. It sounds like other states where Safeway is actually in operation. And I know the previous witness indicated that the restrictions that are in place in Washington have been effective, and so it kind of makes me think that these kinds of things that were effective in Washington were not quite going that far as I see it, and it seems to be a reasonable accommodation. But anyway,
I know in an earlier conversation I was having with the gentleman, they said they had found the greatest source of the already produced product was coming from Mexico and from outside the state, even outside the United States. And so it was more the import of the finished product that was causing the rise of usage and the product being on the street. So, which you're not addressing here at all, but it does account for the fact that they haven't had a lowering of methamphetamine interest.
Right. So. I think Washington and Oregon and California, they're in a difficult position. They've got the I-5 corridor,
sure.
and discussing it with law enforcement officials in other states. I mean, it's a major transportation route from Mexico up through their states. Thankfully, it doesn't come as far as Alaska. And I would, I think that the troopers would be happy if the methamphetamine production in Alaska were really stopped or at least greatly reduced the way it has been in other states that have adopted provisions like this, and that all they had to concentrate on were the airports and the mails and things like that. I think they'd be very pleased with that as a result.
Thank you. Did you have anything you wanted to say?
I know the sponsor, Chairwoman, I know that the sponsor is in favor of the logs. I think there's some gentlemen from DPS who can speak to them and why they think they're important to them, and maybe they're the ones we need to listen to at this time.
Madam Chair, I can speak a little bit to the logbooks and why I think they're necessary. I don't know how much additional. I think that there's a provision in Section 6 of the bill which makes it a crime to purchase a certain amount of pseudoephedrine products within a 30-day period. I think without logbooks or without some positive proof of those purchases tied to a specific purchaser, I don't think that is really going to be a prosecutable offense. Oftentimes, we are going to find out information about people who bought an excessive amount of pseudoephedrine. We'll get that information from tips from the retail outlet. I think unless it's backed up by something that clearly ties in a purchaser to a certain amount, we aren't going to be able to do anything with that. We are going to get tips from other methamphetamine users. I mean, who's your supplier? How do you get the pseudoephedrine? And they're going to say, John Doe gets it for us and gets it at at a certain location. We can't really do anything with that information. I mean, the source of that information is pretty suspect, and unless we have something concrete to back it up, we aren't even going to be able to get a search warrant. So I think that it's really important in terms of making this bill overall effective to have the logbooks in terms of getting search warrants and being able to prosecute these cases. I think it's also, and this is something I mentioned last night, the logbooks themselves and are an effective deterrent. The kind of individuals who collect the pseudoephedrine and provide it to a manufacturer, they're often users themselves. The effects of methamphetamine often is to make you paranoid. They aren't going to want to show IDs and sign and things like that. So I think just those factors alone of having to do something affirmatively are going to make a difference. I'm not certain from the testimony that we heard from the Safeway representatives, I'm not certain exactly what they're offering in exchange. They do have some cameras. Wasn't exactly clear how much they can see from those cameras. Sounds like they've had shoplifting and the cameras maybe weren't effective to deter that. I think that even if you have cameras showing people coming into the store, showing people going up to the counter, unless you can really tie that to a specific transaction, tie that to a specific amount, tie that to a specific person, it's going to be maybe interesting information, but not anything that really can be used by an investigator to pursue it further. You know, I think the other point is, and this is something I mentioned last night, and I think it bears repeating because not all the members were here, and that is that before the state of Iowa enacted their pseudoephedrine restrictions, there was a survey taken by a university in Iowa to gauge public reaction to that, and they found that overwhelmingly the public supported those provisions, supported having to show ID, supported having to sign, supported limitations on the amount that they could purchase because they understood the importance of doing so. And I think that, given that the public supports it, I think it's an important step. Law enforcement supports it. I think the public is going to support it. And I think that the sponsor has worked very hard to address as many concerns as possible from the retail industry. And the sunset provision, I think, gives us an opportunity to say, is this really working? Is it working the way it was intended? And if it's not, it goes away. I think the fact that the Department of Public Safety has to adopt regulations, governing the logbooks and how much information is included there, is an opportunity for the retail industry to have input with the people who are actually going to be investigating and to work out something that works for everybody. But I mean, we really have, we've got these large retail organizations that may have some level of high technology keeping track of some transactions. We also have very small ones, and the logbook was a way of providing a uniform method of collecting information that really is going to work for small stores and large stores as well, and that's why it was chosen. I think it's something that's worked in other states. I think it'll work here, and that's what's on the table.
Thank you. Senator Wilkin.
Madam Chair, this is a good bill, and a lot of work has gone into it. It's a compilation of, I think, two or three different authors, and I'd like to see it move ahead because I'd like to see the parts of it that will do some good be put in place and 90 days after the governor signs it. But I am concerned about the log issue, and I struggle, but when I listen to Mr. Guarnelli, whom I respect very much, and then I listen to the retailers, and they give me their scenarios of why logs are nice, but they really don't work, and what they do is burden the consumer in the end. So I'm wondering, to move us ahead, Madam Chair, if we couldn't just take the log part out of this bill, move the bill and have it become law, and then over time, I'm sure the sponsor would work with the retailers and figure out a way to make this less intrusive, and even if that wouldn't happen, then perhaps the reverse sunset would work. We would find out that perhaps all these things are working, but there would be a reason why to put the logbooks in. And so then we'd come back and have a point of discussion about the logs and what they would bring to what this bill already does. And with that, I would be comfortable with supporting the bill, but I don't think we've done enough work on what affects the retailers and what affects the consumer, not only in big stores like we've heard from today, but the little stores, the C stores, and the stores out in rural Alaska. I think that there's got to be some work done so that we're not burdening the retailer and the consumer in the end for something that perhaps provides only marginal benefit and may even be an intrusion into one's privacy. So I'd be supportive of that, but I throw that on the table just for the committee to think about.
Thank you. I know I want to help get this moving along too, and I don't think it has the opportunity to do so with the log in. And if there's another part of the bill that can be strengthened in exchange for that. And I know I've had a couple of suggestions given to me. One has to do on page 9. If you could help me look at that and see where we are.
Madam Chair, are we working off
I think
V?
Off of V.
V.
Is that correct?
V, Victor, yes.
Yes.
Toward the end of, you go through line 18 after crystal iodine, add, which would mean a wholesaler, manufacturer, distributor of products containing ABC, are there salts, isomers or salts of isomers or iodine or crystal iodine, has an affirmative duty to report to a law enforcement agency or offices suspicious purchases, comma, shall keep complete records of all transaction and continue with the rest of the track. I have this written if you'd like to have it. And strengthen that, and then there's also a section on line, on page 10, lines 19 through 21. Could that be strengthened in a reporting, as a reporting standard? Dean?
Madam Chair,
are we
you know, I think there is an opportunity to to strengthen that if, but without taking a lot of the committee's time and deciding what's a suspicious purchase,
I know.
You might want to leave that to regulations adopted by the Department of Public Safety. In other words, they could outline what are suspicious purchases that would then trigger some reporting. That might be an opportunity for.
Do you think the language in as it is in on page 9 and page 10 gives enough leeway to make those kinds of requirements?
I know the legislature and the legislative regulation review committee looks very carefully at the specific language that gives agencies the authority to adopt administrative regulations, and often if it isn't crystal clear, agencies are criticized for doing so. So if there were some specific language that could be, and it wouldn't take long for us to put that in here, but some specific regulation-making authority to do that. And now that I think about it, Senator Wilkins' idea of kind of a reverse
sunset.
I mean, that's an interesting idea, and it may be. I guess the question is, would it be the desire to have this matter come before the legislature again, or let's say at some point in the future, let's say a year from now, or so. The Department of Public Safety, the Commissioner of Department of Public Safety, certifies that there has not been any significant reduction in the diversion of pseudoephedrine from legitimate sources to the manufacture of methamphetamine, and then has the ability to adopt a regulation that would require logbooks at that point. So I guess the question is, does the legislature want to revisit this in a year? Or with some certification by the Department of Public Safety.
Okay, but we wouldn't be preordaining anything. We'd just say it would be a look-see.
Correct.
By a date certain. Okay. Well, you know, I think this is probably more than we want to do at this table, and I know that Representative Ramirez and Senator Guess would probably want to be in on the conversation. And I know I have staff, and then Senator Wilkin has an interest, and if we can get that back before us in a written form or something that can be worked out that is agreeable, then we'll consider it. Okay?
Okay. I'll really work in that direction.
Good.
Thank you.
Homework. We'll put 189 aside for the time. Okay, HB 169. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairwoman. This is, for the record, I am Heather Nabriga, staff to Representative Roekberg. House Bill 169. Basically does two things. We are providing for 20 hours of post-licensing education for realtors. So this is after they have taken the class and have passed their licensing exam. We will require within the first year of their initial license to receive 20 hours of practical education to be set forth by the Real Estate Commission. And the other provision in the bill allows is on page 7, section 12. We're allowing real estate brokers to contract with and pay attorneys and associate brokers to help them in reviewing real estate transactions before they close. This helps larger brokerage firms with their duty. They have, each broker has a duty to review every single file before it closes, but that's kind of onerous for very large firms. So we're allowing them the ability to hire attorneys or associate brokers to help them in reviewing each transaction before it closes.
So if they're willing to sign off that responsibility to an associate or an employee, but that broker, the main broker, would still ultimately be responsible?
That is correct.
That's the burden. Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. What is the normal, or what is the requirement now for education or continuing educational requirements?
I believe it's 20 hours every 2 years, Madam Chair, for, and that is just normal continuing real estate education, which is going to be different and will still continue to be a requirement. This won't change that requirement. This is going to be 20 hours in your first year of practical information on writing contracts, working with clients, things that most, right now what they do is when you start to work in a real estate firm, the broker kind of helps along the new licensees, real estate licensees, learning how to do the everyday practice of real estate. There really is no set education that we have, and so, and some firms don't even help their new licensees do this. It's just up to each individual firm. So this would be 20 hours of practical, everyday practice of real estate education. And there's a member from the real estate industry who can probably help better answer that question if you wanted more details on the differences between the two types of education.
Would line. You like to hear?
Well, actually, I wouldn't.
Okay. Is that Peggy?
Yes.
Okay. Maybe she could come forward and pronounce her name. Are you that afraid?
This is Peggy Ann McConaughey, and I'm here representing the Alaska Association of Realtors. I need to get her
welcome.
Let's see, to answer your question, the way the real estate laws currently are set, to get into the industry, you have to have 20 hours of prescribed pre-licensing education. Then once you get your license, you take 20 hours of education, 8 of which are what they call required. The Real Estate Commission says this is the 8 you must have. The additional 12 is a variety of courses that they could take. It's dictated by a list that's been prepared by the Real Estate Commission and is in regulation. What we're looking at here is something that actually 18 states already have within the United States as far as post-licensing education. And their concerns are, and our concerns as an industry are, we want to make sure that these licensees have actual practical education as to how to do the job they're supposed to do. One of the benefits of post-licensing education, it has within the 18 states that have post-licensing dramatically reduced the incidence where a public member has to complain about a licensee because they're not properly educated. And we as an industry believe that it will improve our industry as a whole. And I might point out this is not only for new licensees coming in the business, but also for those people who've been in the business and then are going to upgrade to an associate broker or broker's license. They too need the practical education in order for them to properly do their job.
So are you saying that industry is in favor of this additional requirement that's going to cost more and to...
Yes, it's going to put us, because if you figure it out, if you get a new license, you have 20 hours of post-licensing education, and then you're going to have another 20 hours of continuing education because it cannot count as the same thing. So meaning you're going to have 40 hours within 2 years, and we, believe it or not, as an industry, wholeheartedly support more education.
We're not going to get a series of phone calls or nasty letters next fall when they suddenly realize they're coming up on their time to take a course?
No, Madam Chairman, if I might, I will tell you that we surveyed the real estate industry, those who are brand new in the business, those who have been in the business a very long time, whether they were licensees or brokers, and I must say originally I was not necessarily excited about being told as a broker what education I had to provide for my licensees, but I've been convinced because 95% of the surveys that we got back said they were wholeheartedly in support of it. The other 5% said, oh gosh, more education that I have to take. Well, I guess I should have to do that because I didn't receive the education I felt I needed to when I went into the business. So no phone calls will come your way.
But in a 20-hour study, would that typically be 2 weekends, or would it be every Thursday night for 4 hours, or how are those generally organized?
Madam Chairman, it will be organized however the licensee will want them, and it'll also depend on what area, because we are very concerned that the person who is, for example, in Ketchikan, Alaska, gets access to the same courses as somebody in Anchorage, or somebody in Nome gets access to the same courses. So they'll be delivered in a variety of formats. We see them at least being 3 days long. It may be once a week for several weeks. It may be over the internet. In any case, it's going to have to be it's going to have to be delivered in a way that's going to work for the licensee and for the educator, obviously.
Senator Stedman.
I have a couple things.
Yes.
Just on the subject you're talking about. So you're not talking about requiring travel to Anchorage or to Ketchikan? Is that what you're talking about?
Correct. Through the chair, we are going to be requiring only that they have it. And it is our anticipation that the current education educator force will be providing that throughout the state. So there's not going to be travel involved. The last thing we want to do is burden licensees with the cost of a plane trip to, say, Juneau or to Anchorage or to Fairbanks in order to be able to get the education. I, in my other role, am an educator, and I also provide correspondence education since I deal with so many people in the bush in the smaller communities. We as educators are very concerned that we're going to give quality education no matter where the licensee practices.
So I'm confused. So are you going to issue correspondence courses, or how is somebody in Wrangell or Petersburg going to, or somebody out in, Yakutat or some other place that's...
Through the chair, there'll be a variety of ways. They can choose to take a face-to-face course in which they may come to Juneau for a three-day course, or they can take a correspondence course. It'll be their choice.
And then just as unless things have changed, I think you can only have one licensed broker in an office, and then there's the other brokers are associate brokers?
The chair, correct. That is the way it is. There's only one broker in any one office, and there may be multiple associate brokers. An associate broker means that rather than going up and setting up their own offices, they're choosing to associate with another broker. So there's one person at the end of the line who's responsible for everything.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just got another question. I'm just, because I do continuing ed stuff too, and I'm just kind of curious on the hours. When you say 20 hours, there's a difference between 20 hours in a classroom and 20 hours in a correspondence course.
Through the chair, I understand that intimately because I provide both 20 hours of continuing education and pre-licensing both in the correspondence and face-to-face format. the Real Estate Commission will be establishing what those 20 hours will be, and they are responsible for reviewing and approving both face-to-face and correspondence courses. In one of my other capacities, I serve as the Education Chair of the Subcommittee to the Real Estate Commission, and we are right now putting together, that's what I say, we are right now putting together matrices for the Real Estate Commission so that they can see what needs to be in a, for example, a contract class that would be basic hands-on, so that they make sure that when the courses come in, they're meeting not only the spirit of the statutes, but they're meeting the purpose of the statutes and the regulations to provide hands-on information on how to properly fill out a contract, whether it be property management, residential sales, commercial sales, or community association management. So it's going to be quite detailed and quite lengthy.
Senator Sibley.
Yes, thanks, Madam Chair. Just one other question. There's national firms that do continuing ed that for different industries where you could call up or go to their website and get a particular course that you may need. You know, and each profession may have, you know, multiple courses, and they'll send you the correspondence course, and then you go ahead and fill out the computerized test form and mail it back, and they will inform you or your broker or your employer, what have you, if you passed or failed. Is that kind of the direction you guys are going, or is this the way it sounds, that this is going to be something that the organization is going to write themselves?
Through the chair, no, sir. You will not be able to go to a national organization to get these classes. If I might give you an example, if I was going to write a course for presentation in Juneau, Alaska, the things that I will want to make sure that a hands-on course dealt with in Juneau would be under the risk factors. You might notice that we have some fairly large mountains and some areas that look like they're probably avalanche or hazard zones of some type. That would be a very important thing to have in a hands-on class for someone. Whereas in Fairbanks, I would want to make sure that I'm going to talk about the intricacies of ice lenses, for example. Any of the national courses are not going to deal with the specifics that we have within the various areas of Alaska, and we want to make sure this hands-on courses deals with that. In general, continuing education courses assume, and please be advised that I don't care for that word, that you already have the basics down. You already have basic knowledge of real estate, and consequently what they're trying to do is improve upon those skills. What we're trying to do is help licensees get the basic skills they need to protect the public, and that's the base from which we hope we're going to create a much better class, if you will, of professional licensees throughout the state.
Any other questions?
I just have one more, Madam Chair.
No problem.
So after a newly licensed person goes ahead and passes their exam and does their 20 hours, and then they do another 20 hours, and so the industry is going to have a 20-hour commitment or requirement per year for however long you hold your license, and all licensed real estate brokers are going to do this 20 hours?
Well, if I might, through the chair, let me explain that the post-licensing education will be required for any new licensee or any new broker or associate broker within the first year that they have their license. Once they have that down, they don't have to take it again, unless they upgrade from a licensed position to a associate broker or a broker position. We will always have 20 hours, and that's completed every 2 years, for continuing education, because our belief is, as an industry, is that everything changes, and it's our responsibility to keep up on new information in order for us to do a better job at what we do, whether it be property management, residential sales, commercial sales, or association management.
One last one. All brokers, regardless of how long they've held their license, every 2 years are required? Or is there an exclusion for some of the older brokers?
Through the chair, no, sir, there is no exclusion. All licensees, brokers, associate brokers, and licensees must take 20 hours of continuing education, regardless of how many thousands of years they may have been in the industry. I would love to be exempted out myself, but I realize education is important. Consequently, there is no exemption. We all must take it.
Thank you. I'm done, Madam Chair.
Any
Yes.
What's the cost for the course?
Through the chair, we won't know until it's actually put together. You'll find that there'll be a variety of different types of courses. For example, the major brokerage firms in a large location such as Anchorage and maybe even Fairbanks will probably have what I'm going to term as in-house post-licensing education. And I don't know what or if they will actually charge their licensees. It will all depend upon, since hopefully we're all good Americans, what the market will be able to bear and what the licensees are going to be willing to pay, and we will soon see. One of the nice things about the bill, it gives us until January 1st to put this together, so it's, you already realize this is something that can't be done within a 24-hour period of time, but it'll give us a six-month period of time to be able to put the courses together, to get them approved. Obviously, first of all, the Real Estate Commission has to approve what those courses will be, but it'll give the industry time to get themselves together and be able to put them into practice as of January 1st.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
There aren't any other questions, are there? Seriously, are there any other questions? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This 20-hour course, that's not a pass-fail. That's just, you have to put in the hours.
If I may, through the chair, when it's a correspondence course, the Real Estate Commission requires you to test the person, and they must have at least 75% in order to be able to pass the course. When it is a face-to-face course, it's going to be up to the instructor on how they do that. At the worst, I guess you could call it seat time, but the way that we, in my other role as that Education Committee Chair, are going to be recommending to the Real Estate Commission is that since it's going to be a practical course, it's going to be based upon their ability to complete the work that's within the course.
Got it?
Got it.
Well, I'm worried about you.
So is my husband, Madam Chair.
You must be very tired. Okay, Senator Wilkins.
Madam Chair, move to report House Bill 169 from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
There's no objection. House Bill 169 moves from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note. House Bill 211, and all the House members as sponsors are, I think, under a call in the House, and so we can get through these really quickly.
That is correct, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Heath Hilliard, and I'm staff to Representative Mike Kelly, who, as you noted, is on the floor at this moment. I bring before you today HB 211. HB 211 is essentially a sunset extension on the Board of Dental Examiners. However, as a result of ongoing discussions between the Alaska Dental Society, the Alaska State Dental Hygiene Association, the Division of Occupational Licensing, etc., there were a couple of changes to existing statute that the groups agreed upon that they thought would make that this section of statute better and more relevant to existing situations. Very briefly, Madam, the HB 211 implements continuing education requirements for dental hygienists, modifies the inspection period for radiological equipment used in dentistry, clarifies the qualifications for licensure by more clearly identifying impairment that affects the applicant's ability to practice dentistry, and lastly clarifies the requirement for specialty licensure by requiring that the applicant meet qualifications for licensure as a dentist in Alaska. That is very brief. The extension for this board and the ensuing provisions contained in 211, particularly with respect to the extension of the board, were contained in the legislative audit from August 2004. Here in the audience is Pat Davidson from the Division of Legislative Audit. She can speak to the findings of the division if you would like her to. Also online, I have Jim Toll, the Executive Director of the Alaska Dental Society, who could answer questions, but I would also be able to do that for you.
Are there questions for Heath? I know, Heath, you know, we just passed that Representative Stoltz bill on, or we just passed
four
out of
medical
here.
Medical graduates.
Say it again?
Four medical graduates. Is that the one you're talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Four medical graduates, yes.
Yep. Does that bill impact dentists as well?
Madam Chair, to my... I have been made aware that there's an ongoing question or an issue of concern with regard to a certain status of license or dental practitioner. I don't believe, the short answer to your question is I'm not exactly sure what the nature of Representative Stoltz's bill is with regard to impacting, but I believe that Mr. Toll could probably speak to that. I think he's familiar with that issue.
Okay, I just thought if it didn't and you wanted to, this would be the time to do it, but if it might as well, it might do that already. Let's call on Mr. Toll, see what he's... Jim Toll?
Yes, Madam Chairman.
If you could introduce yourself and say who you represent, please.
My name is Jim Toll. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Dental Society. I regret that somebody will have to give me a brief explanation of the other bill in question. It is my understanding that no one can get licensed in the state of Alaska unless they have graduated from a dental school which is accredited by the Commission on Dental Accreditation, which is a quasi-governmental operation that is supported by the American Dental Association. Does that clarify?
What are you saying is supported by the American Dental Association?
Well, the Commission on Dental Accreditation is at arms, is one of those organizations which operates at arm's length, but is under the auspices of the American Dental Association.
Right.
That is the Commission on Dental Accreditation. In Alaska, in order to be licensed as a dentist, dental hygienist, you must graduate from a school which is accredited by the Commission on Dental Accreditation. So if you are a graduate of a foreign dental school and you apply for licensure in Alaska, you would not be eligible for licensure until you attended and were graduated from a CODA-accredited school, which would be essentially a U.S. or Canadian school.
Okay, are you aware that we just passed legislation concerning MDs?
That would have changed that? No, I am not.
Yes, and my question is, if we just passed the law pertaining to what was the description, Senator Olson? Medical doctors?
Yes, it is. It's physicians.
Physicians?
Yes.
Does that ever go over and include a DDS?
No, not
only where boards. DDSs are dual degreed as a DDS-MD.
And that's the only time they would be interacting.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I guess if everyone gets together and decides they want that, then we'll work on it another time. Are there any other questions for Heath? Pat Davidson, did you have anything you needed to bring to us? Does anyone have questions for Pat? Senator Wilkin.
Madam Chair, move to report House Bill 211 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senate Bill 211 moves from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes, as there is no objection. Awesome. Okay, Shalom, shall we wait for Representative McGuire?
She's actually on the floor right now. I could pull her off the floor if you would prefer.
I think they're under a call. I mean, did she personally want to testify?
I can do it. Okay. I'm perfectly fine.
Go ahead.
Okay. For the record, my name is Shalon Szymanski, and I'm staff to Representative Liesl McGuire, and I'm here today to present to you House Bill 225. I'll be brief. The bill is pretty straightforward. It basically requires that the Commissioner of Health and Social Services appoint a second medical examiner in the state of Alaska. Right now, we only require that one state medical examiner handle the entire caseload. Last year alone, there were close to 1,100 cases that were filed with the state medical examiner's office. And with our one state medical examiner. He is responsible for duties that range from autopsies to administrative duties and legal duties, such as testifying in court. Under current state law, we require that autopsies be done on in cases where there has been a crime involved or it was a suspicious death, but sometimes those cases don't always receive the autopsies. We also have to take into consideration that if that medical examiner, the one medical examiner that we have, if he becomes ill or for whatever reason cannot fulfill his duties, that we don't have any backup. And that's basically it. I'll keep it brief. We have Dr. Monsander here also who can give testimony if he would like. And I'll take any questions you may have.
Does anyone have any questions for Sean? Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We heard this in Hess, and my concern in Hess was that the legislature was doing the administration's job. Can the administration hire this deputy medical examiner without this legislation?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman,
Wilkin,
I apologize. We can hire a second medical examiner if the funds are available. The problem with that is sometimes we won't always have those funds available to hire a second medical examiner. In that case, we would run into the same problem that we are now, and we'll have many cases that we're overlooking. We could.
Madam Chair, I guess it just bothers me structurally that the legislature looks and sees that we or a legislator or half a dozen thinks that a certain agency needs a particular position, and so we just go do it. And it seems to me that that's why we have the budgeting process, that's why we have the separation of powers, that comes up through the budget, and we decide every year whether it has the importance to deserve to be funded. I mean, that's just the way it works. And so I'm a little concerned that this starts a precedent that I'm not sure the legislature wants to start. And if indeed we need a deputy medical examiner, the administration ought to come to this table and put it in the budget and have us vet it and fund it if indeed we find it necessary.
Through the chair, if I could, Senator Wilkin, just to express our concern is that this is a problem that's not going to go away. If anything, the population could grow in the state of Alaska. And to be completely honest, people will continue to die. It's a problem that it's going to continue to be a problem. We're always going to need a second medical examiner. So that's just, it's an issue that needs to be dealt with. And that's the only reason why we bring this forward.
I appreciate that.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm not sure how you want to go, and I just want to speak to the need for it. I certainly knew Dr. Probst back when he was there, one of the original medical examiners during my medical career. Dr. Falico is, you know, he's certainly of retirement age, and he is overworked. And I know Dr. Thompson personally, just had dinner with him the other night and spoke about some of the requirements that are there, and it certainly is. Those two gentlemen are the only two people that have the ability to go in and fill something like this. Unfortunately, Dr. Thompson is not really interested in it, but I think Dr. Falico has worked to the bone and has done a very good job of trying to keep up, but he's only human, and I certainly speak in favor of getting a deputy medical examiner because of the intensity of the need. How it's funded, I think, is up to us.
Kind of concerned that it's not, there's no, it's a zero fiscal note, so I'm not sure how this gets funded if they take the Senate's operating budget. I share Senator Wilkin's concern. I don't recall in my tenure here demanding through this process that are requiring a position to be filled. It's always been on the budget side and in the process of either being convinced by the department or either convincing the department that it's a good thing to do expansion or whatever. But let's see, we have Dr. Monsager. Would you like to testify, please?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, I'm Dr. Monsager, Director of the Division of Public Health. I just have a couple of comments in respect to the comments that have been made here. We currently do have budget for two medical examiners. In fact, just yesterday, we made a job offer for a deputy. It's taken us about 6 or 7 months since we had a vacancy. What I see the advantage of this bill is that it mandates that we will always have at least two, which I think has already been stated is a minimum for this state. The budgetary issues, the reason there's no fiscal note is we currently do have funds for two medical examiners. In practice in the past, we would have appointed the second person as a deputy. Now with this legislation, if it passes, we always shall appoint that person as a deputy. In the future, the state's needs, as Senator Wilkin has said, need to be vetted with the legislature. I think you can expect to see me back in the next couple of legislative sessions talking about needs in this area around the budget support for this office in general.
I'm sure you talked to him.
One last comment is the governor's budget did have $100,000 in it. It's still on the House side. That'll help deal with the infrastructure and support to make these two as functional as possible. I'm hopeful in the conference committee that that might
be. So that's why you have a zero fiscal note.
That's correct.
You have the fee for the amount for the second hire in your current budget. Okay.
That's why I didn't think that we could ask for more because of that.
Minor sneaked it through. Are there any other questions? Senator Wilkin, did you have any further comment or any further information you needed? Or?
No, okay. I've said my concerns.
Thank you. Give us a motion, please. Okay.
Madam Chair, move
Senator Olson, would you move the bill from committee, please?
Madam Chair, move to report House Bill 225 from Committee of Individual Recommendations and attach fiscal note.
Leave it is, please. House Bill
123. You still have a motion to.
I'm sorry. Would you repeat what you said?
We never voted on the last bill.
I don't think
we
there was.
We only have a motion. Is there objection to moving out House Bill 225? No objection. House Bill 25 moves out of committee with individual recommendation and fiscal notes. Very good. House Bill 123. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Josh Appleby. I'm staff to Representative Tom Anderson. Like all the other representatives, I'm currently on the floor. We have House Bill 123 is a board extension bill, one that extends the sunset date of six different boards. These are good boards and have each been recommended for extension by the Division of Legislative Audit. House Bill 123 extends the sunset for the boards of barbers and hairdressers, social work examiners, pharmacy, professional counselors, psychologists and psychological associate examiners, and veterinary examiners. The House Labor and Commerce Committee adjusted the standard extensions to meet the recommendations by the legislative audit as follows. We've extended the Board of Barber and Hairdressers to 2011, the Board of Social Work Examiners, Board of Pharmacy, Board of Professional Counselors, and Board of Psychologists to 2010, and the Board of Veterinary Examiners to 2009. Additionally, there is a provision allowing the Board of Psychology and Psychological Associates to adopt regulations that recognize other credentialing organizations. Currently, the statute provides for licensing by credential through the American Board of Professional Psychology. In adopting regulations regarding licensing by credentials, the board must ensure that those requirements are essentially similar or higher than those requirements for licensure under this chapter. Other than that, Madam Chair, it's a pretty straightforward bill, and we do have Pat Davidson from the Division of Legislative Audit here to address any specific questions from each of these boards.
So we have a cluster on one bill. And they're just, these are all just routine extensions.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Except for the psychology. We've got a little screen group. Okay. Other questions for Josh? Pat, did you want to have, do you have anything to report, please? Did you have other questions there?
I just have a short one. I'm not sure, sir. We need a full board of barbers. Some of us. Never mind, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
What a discount.
No comment. Pat.
For the record, Pat Davidson, representing the Division of Legislative Audit. I just wanted to make a few comments with regard to the extension dates. This year, there were 12 boards and commissions up for sunset, which is about twice the normal. And so when we made recommendations for extensions, we used a variety of 4 to 6 years. And that's why you see these boards coming up at different than the standard 4-year extension. Additionally, as it relates to the financial condition of the boards, previously the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers had been running at a deficit. However, they have increased fees and they are now covering their costs. Social Work Examiners is doing fine with regard to their financial status. We made a recommendation to the division that the Board of Pharmacy fees needed to be increased. Professional counselors is satisfactory with regard to their fees. We did recommend a fee increase for the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associates, and the Board of Veterinary Examiners is doing sufficiently.
Are there any questions about any of these boards and the extension dates? Read for these, please. Wilson, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. It's on page 2, line 25, which is line 3, there's an addition of adding another way of being licensed. So is that, am I interpreting that, that somebody that's got the experience to go ahead and qualify for the credentialing organization is allowed to go ahead and be licensed?
Through the chair, okay. Senator Olson, the requirements, as long as they are essentially similar or higher to what's already required, that's correct.
Okay. And what was the reason for it? Are there people here that...
Senator Olson.
Oh, and what is the reason for that? Are there people here in the state that are qualifying or need to be certified that aren't there now that are providing services?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, it's very much kind of in line with the previous bill from from Representative Stoltz, mm-hmm. being able to, you know, increase the number of people who are allowed to practice as long as they meet those qualifications.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Are there any other questions? Are there any of these boards that are being extended that any of the members would like to kind of take a look at overnight and bring this back tomorrow, or is it okay to pass this out today? You might object. Senator Wilson.
Madam Chair, move to report House Bill 123 from committee with individual recommendations and attach fiscal note.
House Bill 123 moves out of committee with individual recommendations and attach fiscal note.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
House Bill 215, Permanent Fund Court.
Since the representative is not here, I was hoping I could just defer to the experts.
Okay. Very good. Okay. Mike, welcome, Laura.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Mike Burns, and I'm Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. We're here to speak on behalf of House Bill 215, and I guess the question before us is, why should the prudent investor rule even be considered as the primary overarching policy governing the investment of the Alaska Permanent Fund? To To answer that question, it's best to begin with the Permanent Fund's mission, which is to maximize the value of the Alaska Permanent Fund through prudent long-term investment and protection of principal, and to produce income to benefit all generations of Alaska. It's not difficult to see that many challenges inherent in the fund's mission, and it's equally easy to see they are often in conflict. Maximizing returns in a manner that is prudent, and doing so over the long run, indeed in perpetuity, and still protecting the fund's principal, while at the same time producing and distributing substantial levels of income annually in perpetuity and across future generations, is a major challenge for those charged with investing the fund's assets. For several hundred years, most trustees facing similar challenges have operated under the prudent policy, which was implemented by a simple constraint: permit the investment of the fund assets in only those instruments which, when viewed individually, and that is a key point, when viewed individually, were likely to produce income and protect the nominal value of the fund. These instruments were few and were primarily focused on fixed income. The predominant, in some cases exclusive, use of fixed income and related securities left the real corpus extremely vulnerable to inflation, very similar to the early history of our fund. Over the last three decades, trustees facing challenges highly similar, and in some cases identical, to those facing the Alaska Permanent Fund have been abandoning restrictive statutory lists as a foundation for implementing a prudent investment policy, and instead have adopted the prudent investor rule as the guiding policy for investment in fund assets. In fact, 44 of the 50 states have gone away from statutory list. The prudent investor rule underlying the prudent investor rules underlying premise is that the primary responsibility of the fiduciary is to ensure the estimated risk and return of the total portfolio, and this is appropriate in light of risk tolerances and the particular objectives of the assets. This focuses on the best estimates of the total portfolio's long-term behavior, along with development of modern portfolio theory that has fundamentally changed the foundation for prudent fiduciary behavior. In current law, employing this emphasis on the whole portfolio rather than individual investment categories, the fiduciary is said to have a duty to evaluate investments in the context of the portfolio as a whole. While the duty to select reasonable levels of risk are targeted to the fund, and diversification itself becomes a fiduciary obligation. The relevant point for the Alaska Permanent Fund is that it is quite possible that either now or at some point in the future, the inability to access a broader range of asset classes may result in the creation of a fund that contains either excess risk or unnecessarily lower long-term returns. To illustrate this point, I would like to ask you to turn to page 4 in the handout that you have. This graph, if you will. This is a depiction of what is referred to as the efficient frontier of investments. The lower line, the blue line, defined by a series of dots, is the efficient frontier for the Alaska Permanent Fund today as constrained by the statutory list. Each of those dots along that line is the risk and return characteristics of different asset allocations. The blue square, where it says March 2004 target, and which actually was updated last week by us, and we have kept the same target, is where we are on a risk and return basis. And the vertical axis along the left is increasing expected returns, and the horizontal axis across the bottom as it moves out is increasing risk as measured by the standard deviation of the entire portfolio. So as I said, where the blue square is where we are today. Our asset allocation should yield us that about a 7.83 return with a standard deviation of about 10.29. What I think is important, if you look at the red arc, the one that is above that, this is what our portfolio could look like if it was constrained by the prudent investor theory, or the rule, not theory, but the rule. What this would, and again, the points all along that are different asset allocation categories. What is important, if you look at, again, at the blue square where we are today, and then look to your left, to the green square, we can get the same return and ratchet back our risk. Or we can go straight up from the blue square to the darker square where the number 6 is, and for the same level of risk, increase return to the portfolio by over 1%. I think the constraints of the statutory list today are pushing us in the direction of higher risk for lower returns, and that's not what any of us are seeking. I guess, questions?
Questions of Mr. Burns? Senator Tibben?
To pick up this roughly 180 basis points or whatever it is, that increase there from dot 8 in the blue up to dot 6 in the red, how accurate is the measurement of that when you have static or investments that aren't actively traded? The other information that we've had brought forward from ASBIB in the footnotes, they don't even put them in there. They say they're, the standard deviation is they're unable to estimate it, so they delete it. Is that?
Through the chair, Senator, are you speaking to real estate or private equities? Or?
Private equity.
What we do is we have included those in our financial projections with their expected internal rate of return, which is the most accurate we can come up with at this point in time. Those are pretty small assets for us at this point. I think in private equity we actually have about $2.9 million on the books, so they don't affect it very much at all. And again, these are historical factors for these asset categories. This is expected return and expected risk, which is all we can do for a projection purpose.
Last year, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Last year, I think there was we increased the allocation by 5% to allow you to go into some of the more illiquid asset classes to help the permanent fund increase their return and in theory decrease their volatility at the same time. And has that been maxed out yet?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, no, it has not. And let me digress for just a moment. At the University of Alaska Foundation, we have a target of 18% of that foundation's assets to go into what are called alternative investments, which are basically basket clause type investments that you spoke of. At the University Foundation, with an 18% target, we have commitments outstanding for putting it up to 24%, and we can't get to the 18. You don't control when the money goes out the door, and you don't control when it comes back on some of these private type of investments. So you need to overcommit if you're going to get to your target. Our trustees, with the power that you granted us through the additional basket clause, made a commitment of $600 million to private equity. Of that $600 million allocation, we have committed, I think, about $240 million. Of that $240 million, we have $2.9 million out the door. So it's a very lengthy process. And to overcommit, which you really need to overcommit to get to where you want to be, and if you can, the situation I don't want to be in is have overcommitted, so I have contractual obligations and a statutory limitation. I think it'd be highly unlikely that all of the commitments we had to be called at one time, but we just can't put ourselves in a position of overcommitting when you have the, you know, a statutory limitation. And answer?
Yes.
The other question, Senator Stepman.
This is not so much a question under the proposal here, but it wraps up into a bigger issue, and that's what we're dealing with, or with the PERS and TERS issue and the underfunding. And there's certainly an intent here, from what I can see, to deal with the $5.7 billion underfunding next year, hopefully with the new board and some recommendations brought forward. And I'm not sure that this is timely, this proposal, and at this time. And I think it would be more timely for us to deal with it next January and February, when we can take a look at the portfolio that the trust assets of PERS and TERS, along with the permanent fund, because the ASVIB currently doesn't have a statutory list, and they have more volatility, and they seem to have a little higher return on the upside and a lower one on the downside. And I just think it would be a nice fit for the Finance Committee, when we deal with that large problem, that we take care of this issue at the same time, because they're very closely related. And I think the education that would be gained, not only from the public, but from the legislature, to run those simultaneously, or at least maybe run this one first and then followed by the other one, would be beneficial. Last year we increased the allocation by 5%, that was mentioned earlier, on the basket clause, and it doesn't appear that that's been maxed out yet. So I don't think we're putting a permanent fund at any major disadvantage. And I certainly recognize that over the last several years, if not close to a decade, or at least quite a while, that they have always preferred to get away from their statutory list.
Madam Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
Senator Stepman, on the timing of this and the timeliness, just a couple of numbers to put in front of you. If we're convinced this is the right concept, and we're convinced, obviously, that we are hurting the fund's performance. Yesterday, just for a very fresh example, the fund increased in value by almost $250 million. It was a good day in the market. But that's less than 1%. With that kind of volatility, if this is the right thing to do, to wait that long to do it, I think, you know, we potentially leave a lot of, or taking on a lot of risk. You know, these are awfully big numbers that move around. And if this is the right thing, we would love to be part of that process, to go through, you know, the whole rethinking of how the state invests its assets. But this would not even take effect until January 1st. We want to get the regulations started this fall, so we would be ready to go. And I think a report back to you as a precursor to how you deal with the new board and its assets, I think would be very timely. But it's your clock and it's your time schedule.
Thank you. Senator Stedman.
I'd like to respond to that a little bit. I think some of the asset classes that you're looking at going into are illiquid, and I would question the accuracy of the pricing. I think at best they're estimates, and then the true value is when you liquidate them.
Through the chair, Senator, I certainly would agree with you on the real estate side. I mean, we reevaluate the prices of our real estate every other year, or maybe it's every third year. I'm not sure. We don't mark it up on our financial statements, but we do take those changes in value into our performance. And you don't know what real estate's worth until you sell it.
some of these longer-term assets, some of the illiquid assets, you have to, what we're putting in here, where they fit in the efficient frontier as opposed to the assets we have, again, are historical performances of these asset categories. Every dot, whether it's the red line or the blue line, these are historical costs. So this isn't performance. This is for asset allocation.
Can I rephrase my question?
Yes, you may.
To calculate standard deviation, you have to have a movement in price. And if you don't have a movement in price, you have to estimate it or guesstimate it. And when you go into an actively traded security, you've got daily, monthly, weekly pricing, whatever you're going to do, so you can gauge that standard deviation, and it moves over time. I think that's pretty much an unarguable fact.
Through the chair, I agree with you, except what we're looking at here is what the let's just take private equity. It is illiquid. It's not priced daily, but the standard deviation is figured from its historical movement, not from its actual movement. Well, its actual movement over time, but I think there's enough of enough history to come up with standard deviations for all these asset classes and historical returns. Whether that finds its way into our operations as fast or our performance as fast, you know, we can't create that kind of a track record, but the historical record of which we're basing asset allocation upon, historical performance, it's there for all the asset categories.
Yeah, I would think that at best, again, it's a smoothing issue with the price movements, because if you don't have something moving in the market to actually gauge what it is, you're going to have points when you sell it and points when you buy it, and vice versa. And the other issue is when we tie it back into the ASPID portfolio, and I recognize there are different portfolios run for different purposes, but ASPID does not have the statutory list constraints. They have more risk than the permanent fund, more volatility, and they seem to have higher highs and lower lows. And I'm not so sure that, again, that we wouldn't be better served to deal with both those situations at a similar time frame within a month or two, when we're not so busy, because you know, these are not minor decisions, even though they may appear to some people.
It's been interesting for me to watch the transition over the years and how it's move very slowly, you know, from the different percentages and the changes, and it's always a tough conversation. So, yes, Mike, go ahead, Mr. Brent.
Well, just through the chair, Senator, I guess when you talk about the valuation of some of these assets, again, we're basing the standard deviation not just on our performance or how these assets perform for us, but our consultant has a universe of 110 funds very similar to ours, and so it's how these assets perform over that universe. So I agree with you completely with your assessment that as we get into these in small amounts, our experience won't be that additive to what the universe is for quite a while, but the universe is there, and it's for our purposes in planning. It's a very valid time frame and returns.
Are there other questions? Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think in my short time in the legislature, this is the third time that the fund has come and asked to change the statute under which they're controlled or how they can invest the permanent fund. And prior two times we've approved it, and we continue to have a fund that exceeds all of our expectations, and we're very appreciative of that. So I understand what Senator Stedman's saying, but I just did some back-of-the-envelope calculations, and if it is 1%, which you said the change is 1%, that's $300 million a year. So just, that's $6 million a week that we're losing if we don't do this. And that's a lot of education. And I wonder if we can't, if we hold up and don't start this process until January or February next year, it's going to cost us a couple hundred million dollars. Is that, Mike, if I, do I, is my math right?
Through the chair, or I guess, chair, I guess.
Go ahead.
Yeah, the math is right. I mean, as if what all of our experts and all of our consultants tell us that we're doing to ourselves, you know, the time is not your friend in this. And if we waited till next year, then we've got to go ahead and adopt regulations. And you know, we just did our asset allocation now. I mean, it's a lengthy process. I mean, we talked to some people the other day, and investment management, I guess they were consultants, and they asked how fast something might happen. And we said, well, this is Alaska, and we kind of move at glacial speed. I mean, this fund is very deliberative about how it approaches things, but this issue's been around for quite a while, and I think today we're convinced it's the right thing to do. It's I don't. Thank you.
Senator Shipman.
I don't think the math is correct, because if depending on where the market moves, if the market advances sharply higher, I would expect the returns to be larger. But if the market went flat or down, at least looking at some of the other results from ASBIB, the results may be average or worse. So it all depends on the movement from you know, when the policy is implemented to your measuring point. Markets don't always go up, and as we know yesterday, you know, if you measure it on an up day, you know, that's one measurement period. If you measure it on a down day, that's another one. So it's not a linear relationship.
Through the chair, Senator, I agree with you. I guess when I was, I understood Senator Wilkerson talking about the opportunity, what might be there. Markets do move both ways. There's no question about it. I'm very aware of that.
Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, but isn't that a measure of risk? And if on the efficient frontier here, we aren't changing our risk. The risk stays the same. So the fluctuation up and down would be the same whether we stayed at the blue square or the red square.
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely correct. If we moved up on that that asset allocation indicated by that larger square, you don't change your standard deviation at all. But I think what is equally important is that to look over at that green square, we can move our risk back to there and keep the yield the same, or any point in between those, and you're still within the same parameters that you've had. I just think it's quite an opportunity.
What I wanted to comment on the bottom of page 4, just underneath your chart, I just wanted to highlight the last sentence and say thank you. And Senator Stevens over here wants to say the same thing. So, thank you, Madam Chair.
May I make one other comment?
Yes, Senator.
My understanding of how this works is every time you pick a measurement period, your efficient frontier is going to change. It's not a static line, and that if we went back a year or 5 years, we could have upward curving lines, or we can have, you know, flatter lines, depending on what's going on. Historically, if you measure ex post, and then if you're out forecasting, you can always use a nice upward curving line. But that efficient frontier is a dynamic instrument. It's not as easy as plotting it on, and there you are.
Through the chair, Senator. Actually, that is not a point in time. That is accumulation of time. Those are historical numbers, and I don't have in front of me whether that's the last 5 years or the last 10 years. Yeah. I don't. But that's. I mean, we just didn't pick a point.
Or
These are historical returns.
Oh, I understand that, but I'm saying every, you know, if you measured it, it's going to change. If you did rolling, if you did a 10-year rolling average or a 15-year rolling average, whatever you do that, it's constantly moving with the dynamics of the economy.
I agree with you. I'm sorry. I thought this isn't a point in time, but, you know, if you pick a different time frame.
But I'd agree with you. Theoretically, these investments should produce and allow the portfolio to receive a higher return for less volatility. In other words, you wouldn't have it.
Exactly. That's through the chair. Exactly.
Senator Holson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As we look at this efficient frontier graph, we see the standard deviation is 3 percentage points there. How significant is that in the whole scheme or in other investment graphs that you've looked at?
Through the chair, the standard deviation, a change of 3% when you're at, today we're at 10.29, which means two-thirds of the time it would be either up 10.29 or down 10.29 within that range. So you take 3 points off each end of that, it's pretty significant.
I understand that. My question has to do with how does it compare with other investment portfolios that are looking at the same type of situation? I mean, are they dealing with double-digit standard deviation risks as well?
Through the chair, I would say I think so. This is a pretty conservative asset mix, and it's a lot different than a pension fund because we don't have a fixed liability. So I think I don't think our standard deviation is out of line, but I think it's out of line maybe for the return we're getting with it. I think that's the ratio.
Are there other questions?
Got one.
Senator Stanton.
Historically, the portfolios are run 60% bonds and 60% equities, 40% bonds, a balanced approach. And I think the permanent fund started all bonds and has evolved over time. And hasn't there been more of a move since the turn of the century, not the last century, but the current one we're in, when the market cracked and we had some turbulent times, especially in the smaller companies and large companies, for asset managers to look out away from the equity markets that are traded on the New York and American and NASDAQ and try to go into other asset classes to tone down the volatility and to try to get more diversification because of the less than desirable indigestion that a lot of us got in the first couple of years of this century?
Through the chair, yes. And we have substantially, I mean, we are in the equity markets around the world. We are in the small cap market, mid cap, large cap, emerging markets. So we've tried to get as good a balance as we can. I mean, still the predominant is the large cap U.S. market, but small cap and mid cap U.S. International has a very big place in what we do. Where I think the bigger change will be is I think you'll see some absolute return strategies replacing fixed income to take the volatility out of the fixed income. And in a rising rate environment, we do have a lot of volatility.
Other questions from the members? We'll take a brief at ease.